Good morning. Take the time you need to get settled. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. I'll just call the next case. It's A22-0835, State of Minnesota versus John Kevin Molina. Council will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, as you're aware. If you can please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument, we would appreciate it. So you can proceed when you're ready.
Morning, Your Honors, Council. My name is Craig Cascarano. I represent Mr. Molina. Let me just get organized here 1 second. In my brief, I indicated that there's 4 issues. I don't think it's necessary for me to go through the facts of the case that have been outlined in the briefs. The only thing I would like to mention, which would perhaps dovetail into some of the things I would like to say, is this is a case that kind of boils down to a he said, she said. There isn't any forensic evidence of any penetration. The allegation was made 2 years after the alleged occurrence. I think that's significant. I thought long and hard about how I wanted to approach the court this morning with regard to this. Again, I indicated there are 4 issues. I would like to concentrate, if it pleases the court, on the 2 that I think are the most significant. And I don't want to indicate that the other 2 are not, but I think there are 2 that kind of raise the eyebrows of, I'm hopeful that will raise the eyebrows of this court. And those 2 are the court's allowing the prior record of the defendant to be introduced during cross-examination with regard to his prior felony convictions. And secondly, the court excluding the presence of the defendant when the jury was polled. With regard to the priors, I've appeared in front of this court many times in the past. I'm kind of a dinosaur. I've been doing this for 48 years. I've always taken the posture that it's sometimes better to never say anything that doesn't add to silence. And so I intend to be brief on my argument. I don't want to expound upon anything further that I've said in writing. I understand the Jones factors with regard to the priors. I've been a trial lawyer for all these years as a criminal defense attorney. I understand the Jones factors with regard to priors, but it concerned me here when I read the transcript as to the district court allowing Mr. Molina's prior record come in with regard to fleeing a police officer. Obviously, the underlying issue on these on the admission of prior felonies is, for all intents and purposes, whether it goes to the truth or veracity of the defendant. It's obviously not to show that he's a bad guy. I find it very difficult to fashion an argument where fleeing a police officer has anything to do with truth or veracity. I understand perhaps the domestic strangulation coming into evidence. I'm not all ramped
Counsel,
up about that one.
You're aware, though, that the case law says that any felony conviction is probative of a witness's credibility, and that a crime need not relate directly to truth or falsity to be admissible for
impeachment aware.
Purposes.
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't mean to interrupt. I am aware of that, but if you look at the 5 Jones factors, the value of the prior, the date, the similarity to the case in chief, the importance of the testimony, and most importantly, the credibility of the defendant. And the reason that I started this whole argument with regard to whether that this case is a he said, she said, is the credibility of each witness is the focal point of this entire case. And so when you introduce prior record of fleeing a police officer, I understand that the law provides that it can come in, but clearly there's factors that have to be looked at by the court. What's even more significant, and which was pointed out actually in my opponent's brief, is that the judge made no record on the introduction of these, which is a huge mistake. Now, whether it's harmless error or not, it's an error that should not have occurred.
Wasn't that a matter of kind of the timing of the trial, though, that that happened? Because I think they were discussing it, and then they didn't go back to it, it seemed.
There was a timing issue that doesn't, at least in my mind, Judge, I don't think it negates the fact that there should have been something placed on the record by the judge. It's very clear that that's what's supposed to happen. It didn't. But again, I think the significance of that is that the credibility issue, which is perhaps the fifth factor on the Jones factors.
Would there have been an alternative, maybe just stipulating that there were two felonies as opposed to the kind of crimes?
That would be preferable in my mind. Yes.
Was that suggested?
Not that I remember in the record.
Okay.
So I think that's one of the issues that the court here has to struggle with, and then obviously the ultimate question is whether or not it would have made a difference in the outcome. Under normal circumstances, maybe. On different cases, it might not. But again, this is a credibility case. And indeed, I believe.
But under the Jones factors, doesn't that weigh in favor of it coming in, where credibility is the key issue in the case?
Well, it does and it doesn't. I mean, the credibility, when we're dealing with the Jones factors with regard to a prior, we're talking about the credibility of the defendant. And it's my position that those, when those are brought up in front of a jury, the credibility whistles and bells go off in front of the jury, as far as the jury is concerned, is whether or not Mr. Molina is telling the truth.
But,
I think it's a better posture.
But
just
isn't
to
that
be
why felony convictions are a bad thing?
Well, they're a bad thing for the defense. There's no question about that.
So how do you, I mean, how do you balance that?
Well, then you just don't let them. I understand that felony convictions from a general standpoint within the 10-year time limitation and all the stuff that the case law and the rules provide can come in. But on a credibility basis, to allow not one, by the way, but three fleeing a police officer case, at least in my mind, that's a far cry from a theft-related offense or a fraudulent offense or something like that. And we all can, I think, agree that a jury is going to look at a felony conviction as a felony perhaps regardless of what the offense itself is. So I believe that that was, clearly it's an error that the judge did not put anything on the record with regard to that, and I believe it was an error that she allowed that to come in, because I think, again, I don't want to repeat myself three or four times, but this issue, of course, is a credibility issue. The more concerning issue from a defense standpoint is the defendant's absence in the polling of the jury.
Turn my microphone
on. I can
on.
Hear.
Are you claiming it's a structural error and so entitled to an automatic reversal, or what's your argument?
With regard to the priors?
No.
On the polling?
I thought you were turning to the defendant's absence when the jury was being polled.
I am. I'm sorry, can you repeat your question?
Yeah, so are you claiming that that's something that goes, you know, that's so significant it's a structural error?
Yes, I am.
Even though the case law doesn't provide there's a constitutional right to having the jury polled.
It is.
Yeah.
I agree with the court with everything you're saying, but I also am suggesting to the court that this is a structural error. The defendant has a right to be present in all important, if that's not the right word.
Well, then so then my question is, the Supreme Court's Polsinski, I'm pretty sure it's Polsinski, opinion, where they said, you know, even if there is a constitutional violation that could be a structural error, we're not going to order reversal in all cases. And so after the verdict's been rendered, this seems like a situation where even if there is a problem, that there'd have to be a showing of prejudice under Polsinski. So do you have any, what's your reaction to that?
I understand what the court is saying. I'm aware of the case from the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
I don't think in this particular circumstance that, quite candidly, I can point to anything that is prejudicial. However, a defendant being absent as a result of a court order in any significant part of the case, in my mind, is inherently prejudicial. Now, I get the fact that we're talking about polling a jury versus direct or cross-examination or final argument or opening statement. I understand that completely. But it's still an important part, or else we would never have it in the first place. I fall on the side of the fence, Judge, that there is a, listen, we can all agree that the defendant's conduct after the verdict was read was unconscionable, and probably, at least in my 49 years, I've never seen anything like it. But that doesn't necessarily preclude the court from fashioning some manner in which the defendant could be present during the polling of the jury. Indeed, the court didn't want the jury to come back live and in person, so they orchestrated a Zoom polling of the jury. Now, the polling of the jury via the Zoom was 5 days after the verdict was entered, and if you can orchestrate a Zoom with regard to the jury coming back, there is some way that you can figure out where the defendant can appear. I suggest in my brief that it could be via Zoom. I don't buy the fact that the jury is going to be traumatized to the point that they shouldn't even see the defendant. Maybe they're traumatized by the fact if it was face to face. I get that. But the judge just said.
But the judge didn't agree with you on that.
I understand that completely, yeah. And I believe that to be an inherent error. And I think that is a structural error. But
is there any case law to support that proposition that it would be structural error?
No. I honestly searched, and I could not find any case law here in the state of Minnesota where a defendant was absent from the polling of the jury and the court indicated it was a structural error. I am suggesting to the court here that given the circumstances surrounding Mr. Molina's actions after the verdict and then polling of the jury via Zoom 5 days later is something that we've never seen here in the state of Minnesota before. I'm not asking the court to make new law, obviously, but I am suggesting that that's something that could have been avoided and indeed should have been avoided. The other two issues with regard to Brady, I don't want to talk about the Brady stuff. I think it's been made pretty clear both in my brief and my opponent's brief as to all of those issues. We tried to litigate that on a post-conviction. It really didn't get anywhere. I'm not sure that that's the strongest argument that I have, quite candidly. I would like to make one comment, though, with regard to the third issue, which is what I believe to be the court's limiting cross-examination. I understand the court allowed Mr. Schirm to cross-examine the mother with regard to, quote, civil proceedings. That doesn't mean anything to anybody on a jury. The whole concept of the defense was that the mom and the child were co-conspirators, so to speak, to try to keep Mr. Molina away from the child. And if you just allow the defense to get up and say, well, there's been litigious behavior, and it's a civil proceeding, and there was a court appearance one day after the allegation, that's all well and good, but the context is totally lost. The whole idea of the defense was that they were meeting together, conspiring together to keep Mr. Molina away, and I believe that the court should have allowed Mr. Schirm to get into the substance of those litigations, which clearly show that they were trying to attempt to keep Mr. Molina away from the child.
Didn't the trial court?
Excuse me?
Didn't the trial court allow some leeway there? Could you have not approached the bench and asked them to go further with that? It seemed like the trial court was trying to eliminate any possible prejudice by going into that area.
There is no question that there was a large amount of conversation about whether or not that should actually be admitted, whether it would be prudent on part of the defense to get into that. But in the final analysis, the court made a decision that you're going to only be able to do this, and if you do anything else, it's at your peril. So I believe that that was the court's indication that the cross-examination was limited to simply, like I say, civil proceedings, which for all intents and purposes meant nothing and just gutted the cross-examination. I have nothing further. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. I just want to give the court a citation with respect to structural error. It's Colbert versus State. Colbert is spelled C-O-L-B-E-R-T, and it's 870 Northwest 2nd, 616, a Supreme Court case from 2015. And this is from page 624. And it talks about structural errors, which are defined as, quote, affect the entire trial from beginning to end and undermine the structural integrity of the criminal tribunal. The polling of the jury, which necessarily comes after the jury has already reached a verdict and that verdict has been read into the record, there's no way that this can be a structural error that affects the trial from beginning to end. This is something that took place after the trial was over. So, no, it cannot be structural error that's then therefore subject to harmless error analysis, and there's been no harmless error.
Are you saying that it was error to not have the defendant present in some way?
Absolutely not. Absolutely. It was not error at all. But I'm just saying that I'm just responding to the question before about could this be structural error, and it could not.
Where a defendant is to be present at every point in the trial, that's a critical junction of the trial, to not have the defendant present in some form, isn't that problematic?
Not under the unique facts, and as counsel referenced.
I understand the unique facts, but could there not have been some way to have the defendant present that would not have impacted the proceedings?
As I point out, and I rely on the specific finding that the district court made in its order, it found that defendants' actions were deliberately designed to either delay or disrupt the proceedings. Given that finding, which is unchallenged on appeal, at what point does the judge have to step in and say, yeah, you're not going to be in the same courtroom, but if you're on Zoom camera, are you going to pull a similar stunt again? And should the court allow you to further traumatize the jurors by potentially doing something?
I understand that, but with the technology we have, you could mute the defendant, you could silence, have the camera off for the defendant, so the defendant could have appeared.
Well, that was never proposed to the district court. I don't recall anything in the record. There was just, you know, could you have him appear by Zoom? There wasn't you could have him appear by Zoom with further restrictions. On the facts of this case and this district court specific findings, no, I don't think there was any error, but even if there was.
Well, was there a request to have the defendant present?
Yes. When the chief judge or the chief public defender took over representation and made a specific request to allow the defendant to be present, and then there was a discussion about, well, could that be by Zoom as an alternative? And so then the district court judge, Judge McPherson, in her order goes through those and concludes that no, he can't appear in person, and also no, he can't appear by Zoom.
I'm just a little troubled that with all the technology today that we couldn't have made it possible for the defendant to be present without any problems.
Well, yes, looking at it now, way after the fact, we can conceive of those things. But at the time, I don't think this was on anybody's mind about how we're going to, what further alternatives we could have explored. None of them were proposed to the district court judge.
Okay.
So, you know, clearly it's the question of did the court abuse its discretion, and I don't believe under the circumstances of this case that the court did abuse its discretion. But again, it just gets back to then, well, is he entitled to a new trial? And he has to convince this court that it was such a prejudicial error that he's entitled to a new trial. And he doesn't even make a harmless error argument. He hangs his hat entirely on structural error, and this is not a structural error case. So absent an argument, he's asking the court, this court, to provide a harmless error argument. And I just don't see that there is a harmless error argument available. All the jurors came back and they agreed with the verdict. So the verdict came in, it was read into the record. I don't see how there's any grounds for reversing it. With respect to the criminal convictions, as I discuss in the brief, I think all five of the Jones factors weigh in favor of admitting these. Yes, the district court should have explicitly put these on the record, but even where the court doesn't, where the district court doesn't, then the court on review can examine the Jones factors, and when you examine those Jones factors and apply them here, there was no error, wasn't an abuse of discretion. If there are any other questions on the other two issues that weren't discussed by counsel, I'd be happy to address them. Otherwise,
I have a question about the cross-examination of mother, and appellant argues in its brief that, or in his brief, that the rulings had the effect of precluding the defense from going forward with a reasonable theory about why mother and daughter would fabricate the allegations. Did the district court's rulings have the effect of limiting the defense that could be presented?
Well, as I discuss in the brief, one of the problems with the argument is there's no pointing to any specific ruling by the judge. There's a citation to one page in the record, but as I note in my brief, there's over 60 pages of discussion about evidentiary rulings and all these decisions. But what I point out in my brief is that, and I drop a footnote down and talk about the original text in which the victim discloses to her mother, and the prosecutor references, the text said, "He did to me what he did to you." And that was whited out. The district court, no, that's not coming in. And it was just, he raped me. So now the state has been precluded from any discussion about this prior bad act. But defense counsel wants to go into this restraining order. That was the hearing that was going to be coming up the day after the reporting and was kind of the linchpin of defendant's argument. The district court never precluded defendant from asking the mother about that. Just strongly cautioned, look, I'm keeping this evidence out. In the court's view, this would be incredibly damaging evidence to be brought in front of the jury. If you persist in going forward, the state doesn't have to sit here and go along with the insinuation that there is this conspiracy. The state will be, then you've opened the door, the state will be allowed to ask the mother, what was the underlying basis for you getting this OFP, which was her allegation that he had raped her. So there's this discussion, this admonishment. You think long and hard before you go forward on this path. And then there's never any further discussion. So I dispute the insinuation that the district court prohibited the defense from doing something. They just strongly cautioned the defense, if you do this, you're opening the door. And there is, as I point out in my brief, there's no counterargument that the judge's opening the door analysis was somehow incorrect. So no, there was no limitations, and the limitations that were put on defense counsel's ability to cross-examine the mother were sensible. And
what about appellant's argument that the reference to the other proceedings was too generic?
Well, we've got a variety of proceedings. We have the mother has an OFP, the child victim has an OFP, and then we've got proceedings that are brought by the defendant as well. At the end of the day, the argument was, and I believe this is in defense counsel's opening statement, is that there's just so many cases, so many appearances, that at the end of the day, the mother and the daughter came up with this, cooked up this scheme to keep the defendant away. I think the defense was allowed to ask about all of the police reports. There were six police reports, I believe, that were made by the mother, you know, calls for concerns. I believe they were allowed to ask about all of those, not the substance of them, but to go through and establish that each one of those phone calls was made by the mother on behalf of the child. She testified that yes, there were many court appearances, and she agreed with defense counsel that I don't like them. I don't like showing up to court. Who does? So the substance of what the defense counsel wanted to get in front of the jury, I would suggest, was allowed into evidence. The mother admitted that she had to go to court a lot and that she didn't like doing it. That is the very basis of the claim that these two conspired to cook up this story.
Thank you. Any further questions?
All right. Thank you. We just asked the court to affirm.
Any rebuttal for appellant?
As I indicated to the court earlier, I've always felt as though never say anything that doesn't acknowledge the silence. Nobody knows maybe how stupid I can be until I start talking, but I unfortunately need to say two things. With regard to this cross-examination issue, there were a number of phone calls made by the mother for welfare checks. There were a number, not just this one OFP that Mr. Magnuson just talked about. There were a number of court appearances that were tried by the mother. And the judge, I understand what the judge said with regard to the statement that he did to me what he did to you. I get that. But that's just one. The court precluded the defense from getting into the purpose of this, which in the theory was that they were, I have indicated, conspiring to keep Mr. Molina away from the child. That was the crux of the welfare checks that were made, the other court appearances, to simply allow the defense to say, well, there were a bunch of court appearances and she doesn't like to go to court. That means nothing to the jury. And I believe that was a big error on behalf of the judge. And I just wanted to bring that up. I have nothing further beyond that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel for your briefs and your helpful arguments here today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.